Chapter 8. Here's health to you and to our corps, which we are proud to serve. In many a strife we fought for life and never lost our nerve. If the Army and the Navy ever look on heaven's scenes, they will find the streets are guarded by United States Marines. Marine Hymn.
Raven Gap, Georgia, United States of America, Sol 3, 14,5300 hours EDT, Monday, September 28, 2009 AD. Gunny Pappas slid into the fighting position and looked around. The front of the position was partially dug away where a lucky HVM round had taken out the trooper who had dug the pit. The trooper's armor was somewhere to the rear, piled into a hole with the rest of the luckless troopers who had died this day. Pappas didn't think he'd make it to the pit. Battalion mass fire. The Pazlim were still pouring through the narrow gap, but at a slower pace, and the battalion had reduced fire to conserve ammunition and power. But now every rifle on the line opened up with a full weight of fire, filling the narrow pass with lines of silver. The Pazlim had already built a wall of their dead, towering man-high in places, over which they struggled to get to grips with the awful suits. They had also been nibbling at it from behind, dragging out functioning weapons and tearing out bits of flesh to deliver to the waiting forces as rations. Now they quit in those efforts as it became obvious something was happening, and every Pazlin in reach began scrambling over the mound, trying to drive forward into the line of suits. The ACS was having none of it. The lines of silver picked out the God Kings and then swept from side to side across the assigned sectors, wiping the line from the top of the mound and adding to it as the dismembered bodies of the aliens scattered to lie amongst their brethren. As the assault faltered again, Pappas heard the second command. Mobile personnel, retreat and regroup. Pappas slid another magazine in his weapon and continued fire as the green dots of the retreating group moved backward on the tactical schematic. They moved fast, leaping out of their holes and running in quick, low leaps to the rear. But despite that, and despite the fire of the 15 troopers still remaining on the line, he saw one suit go red, then two, five. That was the last, though, as the remainder of the battalion made it around the curve of the mountain and disappeared over his screen. The Pazlin had not been idle. The forces backed up behind the wall of flesh at the first cries that the suits were retreating, redoubled their efforts to close with the battalion scrambling over the mound and through the lower patches. They were met with fire, but not enough. Despite the interlocking fires of the remaining suits, some of the Pazlin drove forward, then more and more. Pappas muttered, pulling another magazine out and slipping it into the well as the empty dropped out. If the Army and the Navy ever look on heaven's scene... The Pazlin were pushing forward hard. A solid block of them were across the wall of bodies. Most of them had dispensed with shotguns and railguns and missile launchers and were dragging out their bomber blades even if the fire-remaining suits piled up windrows of bodies. But each windrow was closer and closer. 50 meters. 30. 10. 5. If the Army and the Navy ever looked on heaven's scene, he half hummed, half sang, as the first normal reached his hole. He blew it apart with a blast of silver fire, but there was another, and then another behind it, all around, and his magazine dropped out. They will find the streets are guarded by the United States Marines. Tommy had managed to get Wendy aside for a moment as the two Reapers assembled the boxes on the top of the hill. It had required, among other things, climbing around the shoulder of the ridge. But with the preparations to carry the gear over to Black Rock Mountain well underway, he could take a moment of private time. He ended up carrying Wendy the last few meters as the side of the mountain got vertical. With ample power, he could apply his full anti-grav system and simply fly around the precipice. "Now that was exciting," she said, as they landed on a relatively flat patch. It was a narrow ledge, mostly granite, with some moss and twisted saplings growing out of the rocks. Under the rising moon, it was an inhospitable and airy place that seemed to speak of sylphs and elementals, a place where Leechin struggled to grab a gray foothold. "So, Superman, what's the big secret?" "Not a secret, really," he said, taking off his helmet so he could see her with his own eyes. "It's just... we don't have much more time." He paused and looked to the south. There was a strong cold breeze from the north, and their airy was exposed to it, but he still could hear occasional sounds from the gap where the Pazlin hordes were pouring through. "When we go back, There's not going to be much we can really do. Just dig in and hold on. And there's not anything really coming that's going to get here. So are you saying that when you go, you're not coming back? Wendy asked, pushing her hair back behind her ear. The wind was hitting the ledge and being deflected upwards. The Zephyrs yanked her blonde hair back out from where she had futilely tucked it in and streamed it out and upwards. I think so, sweet. Tommy toggled on a white light and looked in her eye. Her eyes were a deep, magnetic blue. It had been so long, he almost forgotten how blue. It's been bad before, and there were always the chance of catching around, but this time... So you brought me here to tell me you're going to leave me? She asked, quietly stroking his face again. The suit under gel took care of all personal hygiene needs, including depilation. His chin was normally rough with a beard. He had to shave twice a day. But under the care of the suit, it was as smooth as a baby's. Maybe a little, he answered. And, you know, we're in a rush. We don't have much time, but... Tommy, she said, pulling her shirt over her head and starting to undo her bra. Shut up and get that goddamn armor off! Mostovich tried not to smile as the lieutenant and his lady joined them on the hilltop. If he'd had the opportunity, he probably would have taken it as well. "Well, Lieutenant, nice to see you back," Mueller said with a chuckle. Tommy had the grace to look a bit shamefaced, but Wendy just smiled languidly. "I guess it's time to port and carry, huh? I hope you can rig it so it doesn't hit my bruises." Mueller coughed. Sherry chuckled wickedly. "That sounds like a self-inflicted wound to me." "Oh, it took two," Wendy said with a wink. "If we're really ready to leave," Sunday said, looking at the boxes, then at McAvoy, "then it's time to load up." He lifted one of the boxes onto the side of the Reaper suit and locked it in place with a gravity clamp, then added one to the other side. It took a moment to figure out, but he finally found a place to add a third, and that seemed about the maximum that he could fit. He did the same with Pickersgill, then had them load up with one of the power packs, an ammo box, and the weapons box, now covered in cloth. Finally, the three suits were ready, looking very much like some old species of worm that preferred to camouflage itself in boxes. With difficulty, Tommy and the Reapers helped the unarmored group to each load up a box. The cases were heavy, running nearly 150 pounds, and didn't have carrying straps. But by strapping them onto empty rucksack frames, they finally got them on their backs. They were terribly unwieldy, but marginally portable. "Let's go," Elgar said, leaning forward to try to get the box balanced. "Take care of the kid," Sherry said, shifting the weight to try to get it comfortable. But really, there was no way to do that. She could feel the straps cutting into her back, and her legs already felt wobbly. "I will," Callie said, looking over at Wendy and Tommy. "You guys take care, okay?"
"We will," Moshevich said. "Keep your head down."
"Will do."
Sunday looked around at the group, then at Elgar's.
"Captain, if you're ready."
"Callie, get back to the cache," Elgar said. "Let's move out." With that, she took a step down the trail, placing her feet carefully. One slip with these damn boxes on their backs, and they'd end up in a pile of broken bones.
"I remember filling this out on my list of future employment," Moshevich said, shifting the weight again and trying to move his AIW into a better position.
"What's that?" Mueller asked. Of all the group, he was the one who seemed the least bothered by the weight.
"Sherpa," the sergeant major said with a laugh. "I always wanted to tote somebody else's luggage over the hill and dale."
"You know, there's got to be a better way to run a war," Mueller said.
Dr. Miguel Miki Castanuelo was a fanatic. Miguel A. Castanuelo had first seen the United States from the bow of a pitching, overloaded boat. And if there was anything more lovely than the faint shred of land on the horizon, it was the Coast Guard cutter that had appeared just as it seemed the leaky boat was finally going to sink. The boat was one of the last official refugee boats from Castro's Cuba. Within a month, all transport would be forbidden. Miguel's father, Jose Castanuelo, was a medical doctor who was the victim of one of the favorite post-revolution games, Catch the Batistas. Dr. Jose Castanuelo had not been involved in the Batista government, but when a colleague fingered him as a Batistas, he knew it was only a matter of time until he would be incarcerated in a re-education camp. Instead, he took his family out on a rickety boat towards freedom. However, a degree of doctoral medicine in Cuba was nothing more than an interesting piece of paper in the United States. Jose never let that stop him, though. He found a sponsoring family in Atlanta, Georgia, and moved his family there.
Then he and his wife, who was from a prominent family, had never before known a day of real work in her life, found jobs in a restaurant. He went to night school at Georgia State University and then Emory, while his children, through donations from the parish, attended First Christ the King Elementary School and then Pope Pius X High School. In time, Jose graduated from Emory, cum laude, in a pre-med track and entered medical school. After the first year, his professors determined that what they had in their midst was not a student, but a very knowledgeable colleague who was stuck in a bureaucratic nightmare. The rest of med school was remarkably smooth. He attained his second Doctor of Medicine degree, stayed at Emory, and eventually became a full professor. His wife, in the meantime, had opened a prominent and successful Cuban restaurant. Their combined income had finally caught back up to what they had lost nearly 10 years before. Miguel Castañuelo, in the meantime, had become totally Americanized. The Hispanic community in Atlanta in the 1960s and 70s was infinitesimal, and his father had no intention of raising his child as a separate but equal citizen. Miguel quickly became Mickey, using Spanish rarely at home and never in public. He played American football and was indistinguishable from the Chads and Tommies and Blakes around him until an announcer had tried to pronounce his last name. But his senior year at St. Pius, it had become a game. Whenever the announcer at some away game stumbled, the entire Pius side would resound, "Castañuelo!" He had decided that on graduation he would enter the army, much to the dismay of his parents. But Mickey had become more than Americanized. He was a fervent patriot. He knew that everything in life that really mattered was represented by that Coast Guard cutter that had risked stormy seas to save him and his family, by the sponsorship families who had welcomed them with open arms, and the society that had let his father have that all-too-rare second chance. He felt he had to give something back. And if that meant a tour in the Army before he went to college, so be it. However, in his junior year of high school, a father of one of his classmates made a presentation to the physics class. The father was a senior officer in the United States Navy, stationed at the eminently landlocked Georgia Institute of Technology. What the father discussed was the opportunities open to bright young men and women who would be willing to give a few years to the U.S. Navy. The Navy was always desperate for anyone who could pass the rigorous academic challenges involved in nuclear power generation, and Georgia Tech had one of the premier schools in the subject. The Navy would pay for the education of eligible men and women who were willing to give 6 years of their life to the Navy. Miguel practically broke an arm signing up. He was easily accepted at Georgia Tech since his SAT score had been 1527 and his GPA was 3.98. He had gotten a B in Latin 1 year and graduated in 4 years with a BS in nuclear power generation. He then went to the Navy's nuclear power school, where we'll really teach you about generation, and then into service with the active fleet working in nuclear boomers, where he developed his long-term love of elaborate practical jokes. Unfortunately, after one tour of duty, he was beached with a previously undetected heart murmur. Unsure what to do with himself, he went back to Georgia Tech and got the rest of a Ph.D. in nuclear physics. From there, he went to the Department of Energy, but at Tech, the second time, his focus had changed from generation technology to weapons tech. He ended up at Oak Ridge, which was no longer in the weapons building business, but was involved in base research. From Oak Ridge, he moved to the University of Tennessee, to which he officially transferred his football allegiance when Georgia Tech started a business school. UT was pretty much right next door and had a long and fruitful revolving door policy with the government facility. He then spent a decade cycling from one facility to the other, with his theoretical research becoming more and more esoteric over time, or so at least it seemed. When the news of the Puzzlene invasion had come, he thought he was going to be going back into a blue suit. The conditions of spaceboard battle were similar enough to subs that submariners were at premium in the fleet. Instead, he stayed at the university in Oak Ridge because it was there that he could make the greater contribution, because the theoretical research that he had been involved in at Oak Ridge was the manufacture, capture, and management of antimatter. Mickey was just a tad on the green side. He recognized that fossil fuels were both limited and an environmental nightmare, not so much from the much overblown greenhouse effect, which was clearly junk science, but from the extraction and distribution end.
not to mention traffic, of which Knoxville, Tennessee had more than its fair share. But he also was a realist and knew that to replace fossil fuels, you had to have something equivalent or better. Petroleum, at its theoretical base, was a means of transporting energy. Hundreds of millions of years before tiny marine algae, not dinosaurs, had gathered the energy of the sun and then died. They were overlaid with limestone and compressed, resulting in petroleum. It was relatively easy and cheap to extract and transport. From Mickey's perspective, the only viable answer was antimatter. It could be produced in remote locations using nuclear power and transported easily and cheaply. The amount of antimatter, the size of a thumbnail sliver, would power a car, or even a flying car, which would help out the traffic no end, for a reasonable lifetime. Of course, if the containment was destroyed, the car would become a nuclear fireball. But that was just engineering. The real problem, which his colleagues were happy to point out, was making the antimatter in the first place. Until there was a way to make it in quantity and control it, he was researching science fiction. With the coming of the Pazline and the Endowi and the Darhel and the it was apparent that his wild ideas were anything but science fiction. The Endowi could make antimatter like there was no tomorrow and microencapsulate it for safety. Suddenly, all the planet's problems, excepting only that it was about to be invaded by cannibalistic aliens, were solved. As it turned out, the Endowi technique for making antimatter was trivial. It was one of the few things that human theory could comprehend about the new technologies, and they could contain it. The latter was important. Antimatter that contacted regular matter converted all of its mass to energy. It was that energy release that made it so alluring. Best of all, it could be contained in very small amounts. That way, if some of the encapsulation failed, there wouldn't be a massive nuclear fireball. Microencapsulating it, though, or even containing it, turned out to be tricky. The Endowi knew how, but nobody else did. But Mickey was a fanatic. Whatever it was he put his mind to, he threw himself at fully. The theory of manufacture was easy, and the Endowi could microencapsulate. It was only a matter of reverse engineering. Unfortunately, that was not the case. After studying Endowi techniques to the extent that they would allow for nearly a year, he came away a frustrated man. The Endowi defied the laws of probability, and that was just not fair. All quantum mechanics, all chemistry, all metallurgy comes down to probabilities. When two chemicals are mixed, there are several ways that they can recombine, but only one way is probable. Therefore, almost all the molecules combine in that way, with a scattered handful combining in others. Often, the alternate combinations are more useful, but they are also hysterically unlikely. The Endowi got the alternate combinations every single time. It was like hitting lotto, not once, but every single time. What a rip! It was the answer to all the problems, not just microencapsulation, but their armor, their drives, their energy, and gravity technologies. All of them depended on hitting the lotto, consistently and dependably. Didn't understand how they did it, and they couldn't apparently explain it in terms that made sense. They just prayed, and it happened. Well, he was a good Catholic, but he didn't believe in that kind of prayer. It was an advanced technology, that was all, but one that he couldn't, for the life of him, figure out how to replicate. So, it was back to the drawing board. Microencapsulation was the key. If he could microencapsulate, instead of using fossil fuels, the entire world, what was left of it at this point, could convert to antimatter. Now that production was fixed, microencapsulation was the holy grail. There was one theory of microencapsulation that might work. There was a material called fullerene, after Buckminster Fuller, the inventor of the geodesic dome, which was a spherical molecule of carbon. Since each of the carbon atoms generated a repulsion zone, any molecule or atom trapped in the center was automatically held away from contact not only with the carbon atoms, but with the rest of the universe. After exhausting every other theory, Mickey threw himself into the chemistry and physics of buckyballs. There was an existing knowledge base of how to produce them and even how to wrap them around another atom. But wrapping them around antihydrogen without it coming into contact with them was a whole nother ball of fullerene. It took time, and the process was not without its failures.
But if Tennessee had anything, it had miners to dig holes in mountains to build the remote-controlled experimental facilities, and mountains. It had only taken three mountains to find a way to perform microencapsulation safely. Well, relatively safely. They weren't going to move it out of Mountain 4 and into the middle of a city anytime soon. In the process, he even got a minimal understanding of how the Endowi were warping physics to their own ends. Unfortunately, what he got was useless for his purpose. Fullerene was tough stuff. To get the energy out of the encapsulated hydrogen required breaking the fullerene first, and breaking it took nearly as much energy as was recovered from the explosion. It worked better setting up a chain reaction, putting a quantity of the hyperfullerene into a vessel and forcing the destruction of a small amount, usually by injecting antiprotons, which then broke up the rest. Unfortunately, gauging the exact amount was difficult. After the first such difficulty, and at the request of the University of Tennessee Regents, they moved the new lab into another mountain until the building was rebuilt. And somehow, he couldn't see GM buying into a chain reaction drive. What he basically had was a handful of black dust that was darn near impossible to get to explode. But when it did, look out! He had an explosive, not a fuel. And had he mentioned the radiation problem? When the initial carbon atoms were reacted, they were not fully consumed, and they released a blast of alpha and beta particles along with a bit of gamma rays. The Castanuello radioactive chain reaction drive? No, GM would not be happy. The violence at the atomic level of the explosion also tended to cause some of the surrounding carbon atoms to chaotically fuse. The result was a spray of very hot radioactive material, more deadly than, if not as long-lasting as, standard nuclear fallout. Well, the Pozzoline had arrived at this point, and they seemed exactly the sort of people that deserved a very hot, radioactive, antimatter-driven reception. Unfortunately, the President of the United States did not agree, so he was left with this remarkably stable stuff that in a nanosecond could turn half the eastern U.S. He saw no point once the process was perfected in shutting down the production facility into a radioactive wasteland. Although it was only really hot for a day or two. On a theoretical level, it seemed like the perfect area denial weapon. And, as had been mentioned, Miguel was a fanatic. "You've got a what?" Jack Horner rarely shouted, so it was that much more surprising when he did. "We can range to the gap." General Carson, the president of the University of Tennessee, was not happy about the call. But he had been asked a question, so he was answering the question, calmly, politely, and with sweat pouring down his face. "We've got a gun project," he continued to the general's nod. "Since the Pozzoline apparently couldn't hit ballistic projectiles, practically every school with an engineering program did. It's able to range. It's lofted a 50-pound package into a low temporary orbit last month. It's a modified Super Bowl 300 millimeter. And we've also got this professor in the nuclear program, Mickey Castanuello. He was considered a bit of a tenured nut before First Contact because he's been crazy about antimatter. Since First Contact, he's been crazy about production and containment, which is why he's been getting a blank check from Ground Force R&D. He was working on energy systems. So he paid for this? I don't know exactly what he was supposed to be researching," the president frowned furiously, "but he finally figured out a way to microencapsulate. Unfortunately, it was useless from an energy standpoint, but he's been from nuke energy to weapons and back, so I guess he went back again. And he apparently got the specs for the supergun, so what he went and built was an antimatter cluster bomb." Callie walked out of the cache and sat down on the exterior ledge, looking down at the long slope to the distant valley. She never really looked over the terrain on this side of the mountain before, and now seemed like as good a time as any. The adults weren't going to be back for a while. To the north, there was another ridge that flanked the narrow valley before her. The valley curved to the east, then back to the south before it reached Rabun Valley, just west of Rabun Nakuchi School. The stream of the valley twisted its way through the former school property before reaching the headwaters of the Tennessee. To the west, there was another line of ridges that the head of the valley, just below their position, were practically a knife edge. There were some trees, even, but with the recent winds, the leaves had mostly been stripped away.
There was a red-tailed hawk flying just above the trees in the valley, about 100 feet below her, and she watched it circle down and back until it disappeared around the shoulder of the ridge. As the hawk crested the north ridge, she noticed a movement among the trees and pulled up her binoculars for a closer look. At first, the figures appeared to be a line of deer heading for the bisecting ridgeline, but then her eyes adjusted to the perspective, and deer only carried weapons in cartoons. "Oh, shit," she muttered. It was a short company of Posleen with God King, dismounted from his saucer. If she drew back, the group would probably pass right by the cache. But there hadn't been a Posleen group in the area since the first attack, and this one was in a really odd place. The Posleen generally tried to stay off of ridges, so there had to be a reason they were here. And the only really viable target in the area was the resupply team. The Posleen weren't all that fast on ridges, but as soon as they got down in the valley, they'd be able to really speed up. And with all the guys loaded down with those huge friggin' boxes, there was no way that the guys were going to be able to outrun them, even if they knew they were coming, which they didn't. She stood up and walked back to the cache, looking around at the kids. After a moment, she came to a decision. It wasn't a happy decision, but it was the only one that made sense. Sometimes you just had to be an O'Neill, even if you were a 13-year-old girl. "Billy, I'm going for a walk," she said, picking up her armor and throwing it on. "I thought you were supposed to stay here," the boy replied, watching as she stood up. "Well, I've got something I have to do," Callie said with a frown. "Girl stuff." "Oh," Billy frowned in turn as she locked and loaded her weapon. "Girl stuff. Okay. I'll be back before the grown-ups," Callie added. "If anybody comes by, get in the Galtech cache and close the door. Nothing can happen through that." "Will do," Billy replied. "Bye." She finished stepping out into the ledge. The Posleen were halfway across the ridge. If she was going to get into good position, she had better hustle. Whistling quietly, she started off along the narrow ridge. She didn't know the name of the song that she whistled, but if her grandfather were around to hear her, he would have recognized it immediately. "Fight the horde," she sang, sliding down the slope toward the lower ridgeline. "Sing and cry, Valhalla, I'm coming." The system consists of 55 sub-projectiles with an Andawi initiator in each, Dr. Castanuelo said, pointing at the diagram on the screen. After firing, the system reaches its target point and begins to spread projectiles. It doesn't just drop them, which would cause massive overlap, but lays them down during its flight. Each projectile has slowing fins. These have been shown to not trip Posleen defensive systems. The system lets all the projectiles attain complementary altitudes. At a pre-programmed height above ground, which is determined by radar altimeters in each sub-projectile, the Andawi containment field releases a burst of antiprotons into the fullerene matrix, which then sustains a rapid chain reaction. Jack looked at the presentation as the projectiles fell out of the back of an imaginary artillery shell and scattered across a wide area. The effect looks similar to a cluster bomb until you realize that what looked like gullies and small hills in the background was a backdrop of the Rocky Mountains. "What's that footprint?" Horner asked. He had commandeered a shuttle and flown down to the university as soon as he got the word. He still didn't know if he had the answer to a maiden's prayer or the worst nightmare since the word of the invasion. Dr. Castanuelo cleared his throat nervously. 35 miles deep, 15 miles across, is the equivalent of a 110-megaton bomb, but with significantly different gross effects. For example, the thermal pulse is equivalent to a 2-megaton. "And you built this on your own?" Jack asked quietly. "Without authorization, or even mentioning it? 110 megatons? "Well, I had the hyperfullerene and the initiators just sitting there," Dr. Castanuelo said hotly. "I thought it might come in handy." "You thought it might come in handy. Just how much of this hyperfullerene did you make?" "Well, once we got the production model worked out, it seemed reasonable to continue production," Dr. Castanuelo said defensively. "I mean, we had the power plant and the materials. After that, it was easy." "How much?" the general asked, smiling faintly. The question was nearly a whisper. "Well, as of yesterday, accepting the material in the bomb, approximately 140 kilos. "Of hyperfullerene?" Jack asked, taking a deep breath. "No, we generally refer to it in terms of antihydrogen atomic mass rather than the..." "You have 140 kilos of antimatter sitting around on my planet?" I thought it would come in handy," the doctor said.
Sure, for fueling Ninth Fleet, Jack shouted. Tell me about the radioactive effects of this bomb.
Very hot, unfortunately, the scientist sighed. It's one of the reasons it's useless for an energy source, but very short-lived as well. In a day or two, the area is down to high background, and in a month it would require sophisticated sensors to tell it has been hit. But none of the sort of thing you want running your car. Fortunately, it's readily detectable.
Sure, with a Geiger counter, President Carson said.
Oh, no, there's a visual chemical cue, the professor said. It was a suggestion of one of my grad students, and it made sense. The truly hot areas will be readily detectable visually, and the cue will fade as the radiation does. But the entire system has not been tested, Carson pointed out, with that sort of quiet calm used when an emergency happens during brain surgery.
We fired a mock-up with transmitters and duplicate Ndawi containment fields, the scientist said. They all survived. If they survive, the containment works. And hyperfullerene has been tested against every kind of shock imaginable. Unfortunately, the problem is not it detonating prematurely, but getting it to detonate at all.
And it is armed, Carson said.
Well, yes, that follows.
Positive action locks? Jack asked.
Not yet, Castanuelo admitted.
In other words, the bomb could be detonated by anyone with rudimentary technical skills.
Guards? Electronic security? Vault safety? The general asked furiously.
Well, we've got it in one of our minds, the professor said with a shrug, and I've got a couple of students watching it.
Look, it was a crash project.
Jack glanced at his wrist where his AID used to be and then at his aide. Jackson, get on the phone. I want an outside expert in here, one on antimatter, one on Ndawi containment systems, and one on guns and submunitions. I want a company of regular troops around wherever this thing is in no more than an hour, and I want them replaced by Special Operations Guard units by the end of the day.
He looked at the scientist and nodded. Dr. Castanuelo, you're right. We did need it. I'm pretty sure that this is going to keep your bacon out of the fire, as long as it works. If it doesn't...
Sir, if it doesn't, I'll never know it, Castanuelo said. If it, for example, detonates on launch, there won't be a Knoxville left.
And if the rest of your material sympathetically detonates, say goodbye to Tennessee.